Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Coming up in part one of today's program, a conversation with the guest vocalist with the Racine Symphony for their first Lakeside Pops concert of the summer. In part two of today's program, a look at the courageous work of military and law enforcement dogs with the author of Paws of Courage. Stay with us. This Friday night is the first Lakeside Pops concert of the summer by the Racine Symphony Orchestra. And I'm very excited that I can spend this portion of WGTD's Morning Show with the vocalist who is coming in to take the spotlight for Friday night's concert at Festival Hall, namely Milwaukee-based actor and singer Doug Clemons. And there's a very good chance if you have taken in either musical theater or opera in the Milwaukee area, chances are you have perhaps seen him. In fact, right now he's also busy at the Fireside Theater in Fort Atkinson. But squeezing into his busy schedule, this performance with Lakeside Pops Friday night. And we have Doug Clemons with us on the telephone for the next few minutes to talk about his life as a singer and actor and what we can expect from him on Friday night's concert with the Racine Symphony. Doug Clemons, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Good to be talking to you, and I'm excited to talk about some of the places you've been and sung and also to talk about, of course, what's in store for Friday night's concert. Tell us, first of all, where you come from originally. Are you from this part of Wisconsin originally?
I say yes and no. I've lived in Milwaukee for the last 10 years, so I think it's fair to say I'm a local now. my family is farmers from Indiana, but my dad ended up getting a job transfer to Salt Lake City when I was 8 years old. Lived there from 8 years old to 18 and then ended up coming here for school. The plan was to go right to grad school afterwards, but I just kind of fell in love with the city of Milwaukee and its art scene here and just kind of stuck around.
Huh. And I think you went to college at Cardinal Stritch, if I remember correctly.
That is correct, yeah.
Right. Ahead of that, growing up, junior high school and so on, were you pretty much the classic music nerd? It was all music all the time?
I had a pretty musical family. My parents, not so much. I mean, my mom, she would always sing around the house, and she had a killer voice, even though she would kill me to let you know that I said that. She'd probably disagree with me. But my dad, I remember, he played the trumpet all throughout his middle school and his high school, and I think even a little bit of part of college as well. I have three older brothers. We all grew up playing the trumpet. We all had the same hand-me-down cornet that my dad had. My two oldest brothers ended up playing all the way throughout high school and throughout college and kind of helping pay for school that way. But I lasted until the end of middle school because I was the youngest. You know, I'm the rebel. I want to do what nobody else is doing. So I gave that up pretty quick and ended up just kind of going to high school and kind of playing the field a little bit. I got into sports. I was in football. Was part of track and field, and then ended up kind of just singing Bohemian Rhapsody in my social studies class one day. And some girl says, "Oh, you have a good voice. You should audition for the play." And I remember saying, "Ah, that's not really my thing." And then I went home being like, well, maybe it is. So I remember kind of going around after that and sort of testing the waters to see, you know, how people would respond to my voice and me singing and all that kind of stuff. Before I knew it, I was auditioning for that show, and I got in, and I just kind of drank the Kool-Aid ever since then.
Wow. So one of those storybook sorts of things. What was the show?
I just remember I'm not really into that. Or that's not really my thing. I just think it's the funniest thing that I've ever said, because, like, look at me now. It's all I do.
Right. What was the show, by the way?
It was Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh.
So I ended up auditioning for that, and I was the Russian soloist.
Oh, yeah. That's a great little... So in the middle of the wedding dance, you get to...
You just come out of nowhere.
Right, with that high G. We just did Absolutely. Fiddler on the Roof in Racine, so I am well acquainted with that moment. Well, good for you. So you ended up going to Cardinal Stritch College as a music major, I mean, to seriously pursue this possibility, or was that not yet really on the horizon?
It was on the horizon. I went to a Catholic high school downtown Salt Lake City, and was kind of, you know, it was one of the many schools I was looking at, but I was kind of getting a better feel as far as scholarships goes when it comes to, like, Catholic education. Not that I'm overly religious. It just kind of happened that way when it comes to money, which is, you know, a good motivator. Anyway, so I came across Cardinal Stritch in some random Catholic colleges and universities book that I had, and took a kind of a faux voice lesson with their teacher there, and we ended up clicking right away. Anytime you get a new voice teacher, you should feel a magic click, and that's definitely what I felt. And started doing some snooping around the Milwaukee theater scene and said, oh, this place is actually attainable, and there is a lot of theater here. You know, a lot of people who sing and who perform, they automatically go, oh, I need to be in New York. But I went there, and I was like, huh, I might be able to go to school, get a degree, and then pay for it by singing in the Milwaukee community and building up my network that way. So that's essentially what I ended up doing. And like I said, I just sort of fell in love with it, and I've been here ever since.
Wow. So in terms of serious study of singing, you are a little bit of a latecomer compared to some people who are sort of groomed from maybe even too early an age. You came to this relatively late. Just tell us about what the experience was to begin sort of thinking about singing seriously and exploring what it means to sing well. What sort of a learning curve did you have to experience?
Well, like I said, I was in band in middle school, and it's so funny that, you know, my professors would probably slap me for saying this, but I feel like 90% of what I know musically, I learned from band when I was in middle school.
Ah.
And that's everything from sight singing, sight reading music, even like playing the piano, the way I approach music. I still, every single time, it takes me back to being in middle school, learning how to play the trumpet and being in band. No matter how many like voice lessons I've sat through and, you know, courses of study I've taken in college, it still all comes back to that. Like, that's really my foundation. But I didn't grow up with singers and with professional singing. The whole business of it all just kind of fascinated me, and I've always been kind of like a pioneering person who loves researching things that I don't know about. Anyway, so when it came to exploring that realm of professional singing, I just started digging in. Right at the end of high school, I was auditioning at any church choir I could get my hands on, any community chorus I could, just because I was like, I gotta have more of this. And I remember just kind of opening myself up as a sponge to just any kind of person in the business, any kind of aspect of the business that I could possibly be involved in. I just kind of went crazy, and luckily my parents were willing to drive me around to all of these things. I remember when I got my license when I was 16, they were so insanely enthusiastic about that. Finally, he could take himself around to all this crap that he's doing.
So you actually did get pretty serious about this pretty quickly.
I did, yes. And like I said, I don't know if I said this before, but we moved to a small desert town called Grantsville, Utah, which is kind of like a last gas stop before the long stretch of desert kind of place. We lived there, from when I was 8 to when it came to high school, and then ended up, you know, finding this smaller, you know, well-accredited Catholic high school downtown Salt Lake City, and we ended up going there, me and my brother just older than me. And then I think just that experience going from a small town to suddenly you're in a very diverse, you know, artistic city, I went crazy, and I absolutely loved it.
By the way, I'm curious, at what point, if ever, did football and track sort of be left on the wayside, or did you continue to try to mix those two very different worlds together?
Absolutely not, no. I probably shouldn't have even been there to begin with. When I went to this new high school, I did it to meet friends, because the brother just older than me, he did the transfer with me, and he's big into sports and everything like that. So I was like, okay, at least he'll be there. Maybe I can make friends. And then turns out all the people I met are not kind of the people that I would be friends with anyway, but it was something to do. So as soon as singing came along, I was like, wait, there's something that can fill my time that I can actually love doing. This is fantastic. So yeah, football and all that just went away like it never existed in the first place.
We're speaking with Doug Clemens, and he is singing with the Racine Symphony this Friday night for their first Lakeside Pops concert of the summer. As I look over your resume in terms of the kind of professional life that you've built for yourself, there is plenty of musical theater and a bit of opera, or at least light opera. Certainly you've sung for a lot of opera companies, a bit more though on the kind of the musical theater side. It speaks to the fact that those worlds are, in a sense, blurring together in ways that probably didn't used to be the case. What do you think of in terms of your primary interests and maybe the sort of the prime target of your own particular array of gifts?
Yeah. Well, I went to college as an opera major, and I was like, I'm gonna go get this undergrad, I'm gonna go right to grad school, and then I'm gonna plant myself in as many young artist programs as possible. And I did, you know, I find a passion for classical music, but there is just something about singing some contemporary musical theater that just sort of spoke to me a little bit more. And it evoked something in an audience that I connected with a little bit more. I said, you know, maybe this is the medium that I should be going after. That being said, once I started to kind of put myself out there as a serious musical theater singer, people started to kind of take me seriously. And, you know, more gigs started to come in and more opportunities started to come in. And I just found myself a lot more invested in it. Not to discredit classical music in any sense, I feel like part of the reason why I enjoy and why, you know, I have the musical theater sound that I do is because of the foundation in classical music. You know, it kind of gives you a giant toolbox, I've always said, just sort of a strong foundation to approach singing healthily and even unhealthily when you need to kind of convey an art form.
Right. I've always liked to say to people who kind of wonder about that, to borrow two sort of outdated names by now, Beverly Sills can sing like Dolly Parton, but Dolly Parton can never sing like Beverly Sills. I mean,
exactly.
the one kind of grounding really allows you to do a whole lot of different things, and the other is a more limited grounding in which you can do that particular thing maybe really, really well, but it does not equip you to sort of branch out into all of the things that might be possible for you.
Oh, totally. I know, you know, opera students are always like, okay, you got to have your five arias. Got to have your five arias you can pop out at any moment that you can just kill and be amazing at. Just learning five arias and digging into just five songs of classical music can teach you a world of education when it comes to technique and approaching music. So if any young person ever came to me and said, I want to be a musical theater singer, I want to be this big old belter, I'd be like, okay, show me your five arias, and then we'll listen to your song.
As I look over your resume, I realize that I have seen you on stage at least once, because I went to the Skylight to see their very, very dramatic, powerful performance, a production of Les Miserables. And it looks like you've done several things with the Skylight, which, of course, is a wonderful company doing such innovative and interesting things.
I feel so fortunate to have crossed paths with them and their artistic staff and even the artists you work with on the stage. Like, there is no naysaying I can do about what that company has done for me. You know, Milwaukee, it's great because there are so many, you know, actors like to have a theater home, like a home they can always go to. And that Milwaukee is fantastic because the city is your home. And any company within the city, you know, is so welcoming and so driven, you know, to make good art and make it fun and make it filled with heart, that sometimes you'll even see a Broadway show and it's just missing something. It's just missing that critical element of people caring for it, you know? Yes, it's a job and, you know, you have to produce a certain whatever and please people. But at the same time, just having that sense of home and that sense of passion anytime, you know, a curtain goes up anywhere in Milwaukee it's something really special and a big reason why I never want to leave.
Hmm. You are right now performing at the Fireside Theater in Fort Atkinson, which I'm sure many of our listeners are well acquainted with. Tell us what you're doing there.
I'm doing a show called Rockin' at the Fireside. They have these band shows that they do, and I think they've been doing them for about 13 years, but don't quote me. And a lot of people love coming to them year after year. They have a killer band that they employ. Yes, they have 10 singers on top of it all, but really the star of the show are these musicians sitting center stage the entire time. They've played with everybody throughout the years. I'm not even going to attempt to name all the names they've played with, but they are just killer. So we're doing rock music from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It's myself and 10 singers. Another guy from Milwaukee, Tommy Hahn, is in it. We've got a guy from Chicago in it, and then the rest are from New York. But every single one of them is killer, outstanding voice. And it's a fun little show.
Great. And then, of course, the reason we're talking with you at all today is because you're about to perform with the Racine Symphony for their first Lakeside Pops concert of the summer, a concert coming up at Racine's Festival Hall this Friday night. Tell us how that gig came about.
Let's see. Pasquale, who is the conductor there, and maybe artistic director, I shouldn't even speak. But
right.
I worked with him years and years ago at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. It's one of the first, you know, pro singing gigs I ever had out of college. And I met him there, and, you know, he's kind of ingrained within the Milwaukee community. He ended up conducting the first show I was at Skylight, which was The Barber of Seville, which I was 19 years old and absolutely terrified, and they gave me, like, this principal role right in the beginning. It's one of those things, like, if I ever come across a tape of that performance, I'm probably going to burn it. But anyway, we kind of kept in touch over the years. Recently, I did a show with Milwaukee Opera Theater and Chamber Theater, a two-man musical that took place in a bookstore called The Story of My Life. And Pasquale ended up coming to see it. And he said to me after the show, he's like, you know, I gotta get you down to Racine. We've got to do something. A few months later, he ended up calling me saying they're having this patriotic pops concert. There's, you know, big band music and some patriotic standards, if you will, and then also wanted to add kind of a dramatic aspect when it came to letters from home, letters to soldiers, all those kinds of things. So it was looking for a performer to kind of bring all the drama to it. So I'm happy to provide that drama.
Very good. So I understand you'll sing then Friday night, not only the Star-Spangled Banner, then Grand Old Flag, Battle Hymn of the Republic, America the Beautiful, and then you're going to be reading some of these letters from soldiers. I assume you've seen these letters right now, or by now, and are already sort of figuring out how to deliver them in the most meaningful way.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's one of those special projects that we have a short amount of time for this drama, and each letter that we're reading, it's only maybe a minute, 2 minutes long. And you're doing it in a concert setting. It's not like you're doing it with, you know, costumes and lighting and all that extra elements, or all those extra elements drawn into it. We're just kind of reading them earnestly, wholeheartedly in the context of a concert.
Hmm. Sounds like a wonderful combination. So have you had a chance yet to rehearse with the symphony, or will that just happen the night before?
We rehearsed last night. We had our first rehearsal. And it was at, it was right in the venue in Festival Hall. And I walked in, and I had never heard the symphony before. But let me tell you, they are the real deal. I walked in, I was like, what? I expected them to be great, but just like the precision and the artistic ability that was held by each person in that orchestra, I was like, what is happening? Like, kind of the I'm not worthy moment. Where I was like, I'm just going to turn around and leave. Like, they'll find somebody else. Like, they got to get somebody from Chicago or some important dude to do this. I can't possibly.
Wow.
And then we're having another rehearsal tomorrow night, and then we go on Friday.
Very good. Well, I know a lot of people are excited, and especially as you describe what a special night this is going to be, it's something not to miss. So the concert is Friday night, 7 o'clock at Festival Hall. The doors open at 5:30. And if people want more information, they can go to the symphony's website, which is racinesymphony.org, or you can call them at 636-9285, 636-9285. To find out about this Lakeside Pops concert on Friday evening, and one that is also coming up a little later in the summer, and other performances yet to come later in the year by the Racine Symphony, and featured again on Friday night's concert, guest singer Doug Clemens. Doug Clemens, it's been great to talk with you, and we look forward to seeing you and hearing you in action Friday night. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
And further highlight the concert that is coming up tomorrow night at Festival Hall. Here is one of the pieces of music that will be played by the Racine Symphony Orchestra. It is the inspiring Liberty Bell Fanfare, Liberty Fanfare, composed by John Williams for the 200th anniversary of our nation's Liberty Bell. And this happens to be the Boston Pops under the direction of the composer John Williams. The Liberty Fanfare, one of the pieces that will be played for Friday night's All-American concert, the Lakeside Pops concert of the Racine Symphony.
Thank you.
The Liberty Fanfare of John Williams. This is one of the pieces which will be played by the Racine Symphony Orchestra for their Lakeside Pops concert tomorrow night at Festival Hall, 7 o'clock. Again, the phone number for more information about the Racine Symphony's Lakeside Pops concert is 636-9285, or you can go to their website, racinesymphony.org. The time is 8:37. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD. Well, as someone who owns and loves two golden retrievers, I am a dog lover from way back, and so it is with special pleasure that I am welcoming to this portion of the morning show someone who is also a dog lover, a woman by the name of Nancy Furstinger, who is also a highly acclaimed author and editor of children's books and responsible for a wonderful new book that has just been published by National Geographic, primarily intended for young readers, but just about anybody is going to be inspired by this book called Paws of Courage, True Tales of Heroic Dogs That Protect and Serve. In this book, Nancy Furstinger highlights the inspiring stories of more than 20 different work dogs or service dogs who have done work of one kind or another to make the world a better place. And in particular, she focuses on military and law enforcement dogs who, in a sense, face great peril and often make a very, very dramatic difference for the better in very, very difficult situations. And I'm really happy to have Nancy Furstinger with me on the phone to talk about this book, which is her first book for National Geographic. Nancy Furstinger, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. And I, too, am very passionate about dogs. I have two rescued dogs myself. And I was really thrilled to profile these 22 dogs that star in Paws of Courage. And it was incredible the number of jobs that they do. Because you probably know that dogs' noses are far superior than human noses. They are 10,000 times more powerful. Dogs can even detect 1 teaspoon of sugar in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. So that's amazing.
Right. What they can do is really, really something. I know that you not only have dogs, but I think you have other animals as well. I mean, you are not just a dog lover, but an animal lover. Just give our listeners a sense of just who lives at your home.
Well, I have a 130-pound Rottweiler named Bosco, who's just a big mush. I have a rescued Lab Shepherd Rhodesian Ridgeback Hound mix who comes from North Carolina, Rosie. And then I have a quartet of rescued house rabbits who mostly come from the local SPCA where I volunteer with the rabbits primarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, you obviously not only love animals, but you love writing. And in particular, you seem to have spent most of your professional energies on helping to develop and edit children's books. Can you just say a quick word about where that interest came from?
Yes, actually, I was an editor at Simon & Schuster for 3 different imprints that are now all defunct, unfortunately. But I read a couple of books, in particular, one by Fergie, the Duchess, and it was really awful, and I challenged myself to write a better book, and that's how I started out. And I slowly became known as an author who specializes in animal topics, which, as you can probably tell, are my passion. So most of my books are animal subjects, particularly this one, which National Geographic actually approached me and asked me if I would write a book about hero dogs. And that was the tentative title of the book, but I'm sure you agree that Pause of Courage is a much more appealing title.
Oh, I think it's great. By the way, I've seen two different indications of just how young a reader this book is intended for. One place I saw that it was for readers 10 and up, but someplace else it was indicated as for readers 5 and up. And not that those specifics necessarily matter, but it prompts the question of what sort of a reader were you thinking about as you wrote this book, and how tricky is it to craft a book that that a lot of different young readers are going to be able to understand and appreciate and enjoy?
That's a great question. The ages 10 and up is the correct specification from National Geographic, and of course, a lot of adults also enjoy this book, but this book is geared toward reluctant readers because it's got brief text and short chapters. It's easy to manage, a lot of action photos. So I'm hoping that a lot of young males who don't particularly enjoy books will pick it up. But it's a whole different story if you craft a book for, say, a five-year-old, which I have two picture books, both about animals as well. The text is much briefer, usually 1,000 words or less, a couple of sentences per page, and it's very heavily influenced by the artwork or in some cases photographs. Which this book, being a National Geographic book, their hallmark is fantastic action photos, which I think they've really captured in this book.
We're speaking with Nancy Furstinger, and we're talking about her book, Pause of Courage, True Tales of Heroic Dogs That Protect and Serve. This is a book for young readers primarily, although anybody of just about any age is going to enjoy this book on some different level. And this is Nancy Furstinger's first book for National Geographic. So give our listeners some sense of the array of jobs that that a work dog can do. I mean, and it goes beyond sort of the obvious or the most noteworthy, which most people have probably heard at least a little bit about. Give us a sense of what that array of possibilities, in fact, is, and how much of that scope is covered in your book.
Yes, I'll be happy to. As I said, dogs' noses are 10,000 times more powerful than humans, which they can sniff out practically anything with those noses. Some of them become explosive detection dogs overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. Others you might have seen at an international airport. They sniff out food and drugs and other illegal contraband. Other canine companions that are paired with police officers are great at apprehending suspects. Dogs can go to a training program up in Maine that an insurance company started to detect the accelerants used in arson, such as gasoline. And then I have some dogs that do jobs that you would never think of. One in particular in Italy jumps out of helicopters to rescue swimmers in distress along the coast. Two in Africa help track down poachers who are hunting African elephants. There's dogs that sniff out invasive species such as pythons in the Everglades. Other dogs that sniff out tiger scat to track down, rare species that need protection. It just goes on and on. Bed bugs, they can sniff out cancer. They can smell when someone is about to have an epileptic seizure. I could go on for another 5 minutes.
Wow, it's really amazing. When it comes to a particular task, I mean, one of those tasks that you just enumerated, are we typically talking about a certain breed of dog that is especially well-suited for that particular task? Or typically could just about any breed of dog handle just about any of these various tasks that you were just listing?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the most preferred dog overseas to become a military working dog is the Belgian Malinois, like Leica, who stars on the cover. They look like smaller versions of German Shepherds. And these are the canine superheroes. They're combined speed, strength, and courage. Police dogs are still primarily German Shepherds because they're loyal and confident. And search and rescue dogs are retrievers, like your golden retrievers. They're intelligent, energetic, and strong. The dogs that you see in airports are usually smaller with a great nose, such as a beagle. And for the arson dogs, I found this really fascinating. The insurance company that trains these dogs to sniff out accelerants rescues these dogs from shelters, and they go into the shelters and they look for primarily lab and lab mixes, and they're looking for the dogs that bounce off the walls with excess amount of energy, because they harness that high energy and they direct it into the job. So it's a great program because they rescue a lot of dogs that would otherwise, you know, not have a chance at getting a home.
You're touching on already on the next question I wanted to ask, which is, for instance, when there is a task to be done and one has a sense of a particular breed that is especially ideal, let's say, for instance, a golden retriever who might be engaged in you know, kind of a search and rescue sort of thing. Once we know that that's the task and we probably want a golden retriever or some kind of retriever to do that, then what difference is there between, for instance, various golden retrievers or black labs or whatever we might be looking at in terms of particular dogs who would be especially good at this particular sort of work? I mean, are there certain things that one would want to look for?
Well, they want a dog who's very enthusiastic about the task they're about to perform, and one with the right personality. For instance, I can tell you a little bit about Brittany, who is a golden retriever who is in the book and was recently in a lot of news stories your listeners might have heard. She was the last remaining 9/11 dog, and she had three careers in her life. She trained to become a search and rescue dog because she had the right temperament and she was very energetic. And she was about 2 years old when she and her handler, Denise Corliss, went on their first search and rescue deployment. And this was baptism by fire because it was 9/11, the very first time she went out on the job. And unfortunately, she wasn't able to do what she was trained for, search and rescue. But she noticed a firefighter sitting there very dejected with his head in his hands, and she tugged Denise over and put her head in his lap to cheer him up, and she instantly transformed into a therapy dog. So during the entire 2 weeks she was there in Manhattan, she offered comfort to people, and she had a great personality like most golden retrievers. She was confident and calm in stressful situations. And she did end up working a lot of search and rescues, including Hurricane Katrina. And then she became older, and she transformed once again into another job. She became a reading dog with first graders. She went into schools and had first graders read books to her, because a lot of kids are not confident readers, and they don't want to read a book in front of their peers, but they'll gladly read a book to a handsome dog. And earlier this month she passed away. She was the last 9/11 dog, and she was nearly 17, which is quite an amazing age for a golden retriever.
Wow, that's quite a story. Kind of training is involved in getting a dog ready to do some of these challenging tasks? And once a dog has been trained, are they sort of trained in perpetuity, or do dogs, in a sense, need to have that training refreshed through the course of the time that they are doing the work?
Well, that's a good question. It really depends on the task that they're being trained to do. For instance, a lot of these military working dogs are trained overseas in Israel or other places by professional dog trainers, whereas search and rescue dogs are trained on simulated rubble piles here. And what I found out, which was really amazing, is that one of the top rewards for training a dog is a Kong toy on a rope. And in case your listeners aren't familiar, it's a big rubber toy with a hollow in the middle that you can stuff with peanut butter. It bounces, it floats. Dogs just love it. So they use that as a reward for the dogs to find explosives, and that's how they initially train the dog. They have the scent of the explosive in the Kong, and once the dog associates the scent with the Kong, he knows he'll get his reward afterwards, playtime. So then they gradually transition over and just have the scent by itself, and then the dog is rewarded with the Kong. And they use this also for dogs who detect accelerants for arson, very similar situation. Hmm. So I also found out that there's two types of an alert these dogs are trained to give. For instance, if a dog is apprehending a criminal and sniffs out drugs in the car, the dog will dig and paw at the car. The paint chips will fly. But obviously, that's not a good way to alert if a dog sniffs out a bomb. So in that instance, it could be disastrous. He will just sit and point his nose toward where the bomb is.
Wow. It's amazing to think about dogs being able to do their tasks with that sort of precision and correctness. I'm thinking about our older golden retriever who's 13 and has both failing eyesight and failing hearing especially. But as far as we can tell, there's nothing yet wrong with her nose. She still seems to have a very, very good sense of smell. For the typical work dog doing this work for the military and law enforcement, what typically are the issues which lead to that dog having to retire from their work?
Well, because of it, because the work is so grueling, a lot of these dogs retire when they're 7 or 8 years old. 90% of the military working dogs are adopted by their trainers, and the other 10% are adopted out to carefully screen civilians, which there's a very long waiting list. I already checked. Sometimes dogs have injuries, like Leica, the dog on the cover. She was sniffing out an explosive. She was only on the job for 3 weeks. She was in Afghanistan, and she was leading her trainer, Julie McDonald, and his team, and a sniper shot her, and she lost her right front leg. So she went through many operations, and she was retired, but they were very the military was reluctant to give her to her trainer, who by this time was also retired, and he convinced them that, you know, she would transform into a great family dog because he had a wife and a toddler. And with, you know, she went through a desensitization program, and he had a muzzle on her when she first met his young son, and he took it off after 5 minutes. She's perfectly fine. She's a real family dog. She does all kinds of activities with them, such as kayaking. And he actually refers to her as his fur daughter. And she too, has a new career. She goes skydiving to test out parachute dog vests in tandem with him for the military. So she's still very active, and she can run like the wind, even though she is missing one of her front legs.
Wow. That's really something. By the way, most of the stories you've told have been either present-day stories or from the recent past. But if I remember correctly, there's at least one story that takes us all the way back to World War I.
Yes, I have five historic hounds that I've profiled, and Sergeant Stubby, was a heroic dog in World War I. He was a pit bull mix and just an incredible dog. He served overseas in France. He sniffed out mustard bombs because once he had been bombed and the mustard gas stings the eyes and it burns the respiratory system, so he never forgot that smell. So when the bombs were being dropped from planes, he could sniff it way before the troops could. So he would lie down and put his paws over his nose to let everybody know that a gas attack was about to take place. So they quick put on the gas masks, and even he had a gas mask designed for his, you know, short, flat nose. He also sniffed out a German spy who was mapping the area. So he was just an incredible hero. I think someone needs to make a movie about that dog.
Hmm. Well, this book is chock full of amazing and inspiring stories. And again, the book is called Paws of Courage, True Tales of Heroic Dogs That Protect and Serve. And it comes from the good people of the National Geographic Society and the author, Nancy Furstinger. Nancy Furstinger, I enjoyed speaking with you and enjoyed your book. Thank you so much and very best wishes to you.
Thank you and enjoy your golden retrievers.
Thank you. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear a remarkable story of two talented journalists, husband and wife, who were caught in very dramatic events during the Second World War. We'll speak with Bill Lesher, the author of Eve of 100 Midnights, the star-crossed love story of two World War II correspondents and their epic escape across the Pacific. Next week's Morning Show schedule includes, tentatively at least, a conversation on Monday with U.S. Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Dramatic events in the House may prevent his visit to the Monday Morning Show, but our fingers are crossed. Tuesday, we will be seeing Dr. Art Sear, and on Wednesday, Mark Eichner.